They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights.
On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew. Radio Fairfax, joining me today is Link Cummings. For those of you who don't know who Link is, because there are a lot of newbies out there, Link is one of the people who was in on the ground floor of building HOAs and one of the three people who founded CAI. Link, thank you so much for coming in. Thank you so much for joining us today. I hope you're going to take us back down memory lane and tell us a little bit about what happened, why you started HOAs.
Sure, it's a pleasure to be here today. As I remember, back then, 43 years ago, the number of condominiums, common interest communities, was burgeoning, growing at a rapid rate. There was perhaps 3,000 of these in the country, growing by maybe several hundred a year. And with every planned community, there's a developer and a builder and a whole bunch of other folks involved. And the idea of having a self-governed community was foreign, and people bought into a condominium or cooperative or homeowner association without fully understanding the implications of mandated common ownership of amenities and common elements and the restrictions that it potentially posed. There was an upcry in Congress that some of the developers were not being fair. So the National Association of Home Builders, Building Homes, the Urban Land Institute, basically the think tank for real estate at the time, and the U.S. League of Savings Associations, lending money for these properties, all banded together saying, we need to do something. We need to have a nonpartisan, nonprofit entity that could independently, professionally research, educate, and help guide the volunteer leaders of community associations.
Look, I want to jump back to before that, because there weren't, condominiums didn't start being built until the 60s.
Well, that's not true. Condominiums, cooperatives, have been around for literally hundreds, if not thousands of years. It wasn't popular in the urban or the type of settings that we had in this country. And you're right, it was in the, I would say, in the late 50s that they really started.
But there was legislation that actually enabled the condominiums, because condominiums are statutory creatures.
I had a client, a cooperative in the district. When I asked to see their documents, they pulled them out of the historical records.
Uh-huh.
And it was the bylaws were 2 pages. That was the total set of documents.
Yeah.
And this was around the turn of the century, early 1900s.
It was a condominium.
It was a cooperative.
It was a cooperative.
But,
okay. You
know, basically the same idea. The residents are self-governed to a set of documents sanctioned by law, the documents being the declarations and the bylaws and then the self-imposed rules and regulations. Common interest communities are totally dependent and built on the concept of the owners working cooperatively together for the common good. The developers capitalized on that in saying we can build a community that is not just a piece of land, just a house, but a whole lot of other things that the collective ownership would pay for in the purchase of their homes. And the individual owners would have an undivided interest thereof. That meant that a group of homes could have a swimming pool or a tennis court or a golf course or meeting rooms or whatnot that were collectively owned, shared, used, things people wouldn't normally have except in a common interest community. The idea of having so many more amenities than just the land and a building, a house of traditional dimensions would provide, was very attractive. It became increasingly popular in the late 60s and 70s. It began to be very attractive. And in fact, in portions of this country, a majority of the housing stock now is in common interest communities. And the vast majority of new starts throughout the country is in common interest communities.
Now, because the local municipalities mandate them, it's a form of double taxation. I mean, look at Fairfax County. You're in Arlington. I'm in Fairfax.
There are some unintended consequences.
Well, I think that's, I mean, if I remember going back the first time I met you, we were at Byron Hankey's house, and Byron is arguably the person, the great architect, who sort of designed these because he was a land planner.
That's right.
And I remember him talking about going out and meeting with different localities, municipal governments, because he didn't like the grids.
Well, Byron Hankey is a giant in our industry, in our past. He was an employee of the FHA, right?
Right. I think so, yeah.
Federal Housing Administration at that time, which I guess has morphed into HUD today. But he was a researcher, and he was charted with creating Technical Bulletin number 50. It is like the Bible for common interest communities. And as you said, he traveled the country, met with municipal and county officials, and the people in those communities as they were springing up. He documented the good and the bad. He documented what was done and what should be done, and then put together TB50, which gave a very comprehensive overview of What is a common interest community? How do you set it up? How do you operate it? How do you develop it? How do you involve the owners, and how do you organize and all of that? It was the cookbook that developers for decades used in the development of common interest communities, large and small.
And he based that on the place that he was living in. I mean, his house was absolutely gorgeous because we held the summit at his house, and I remember him taking me to his bathroom. He said, this is the mirror I shave in every day, and he had the most incredible view of the Chesapeake Bay.
Well, for 30 or 40 years, he and his family lived in a lovely medium-sized house in Chevy Chase, Maryland.
Yeah.
But early on, he bought a lot in a place called Scientist's Cliffs.
That's right, yeah.
Maryland.
Yeah.
Just near the atomic energy plant. Scientist's Cliffs is one of those very unique places where on the shore of the Chesapeake Bay, sometimes hundreds and thousands of year old shells appear, and it becomes an incredible, even to this day, an incredible place to go play, to walk, to dig and explore.
Yeah.
He built literally a porch, just a porch. We might call it a deck today, but he had no house. It was just a porch. And as his family grew up, they spent weekends and summers there. And I guess after 8 or 10 years, they built a little shed. I think it was like 8 by 10 feet or 12 feet, enough to store cooking stuff and leave their sleeping bags inside.
Yeah.
And for perhaps 2 decades, maybe more, they used that. And as Anne and Byron aged, he thought quite brilliantly, why don't I build some place that I can live and retire? It's like a senior living facility. What he built was about 10,000 square feet. It had basically 3 houses in one. It had one large kitchen, one large dining room, and it had 3 large suites and 2 offices. An office for him, because he was still very active, and an office for his wife, who was equally active. Each suite had a bedroom, a sitting room, which you could call a living room, another room that was like a parlor, and of course a bathroom. His concept is he wanted a place for he and his wife to be able to live the rest of their lives, knowing that as we grow old, he would one day need help. And so the other suites were first for his family to be able to come and visit without imposing, and later on to have caregivers live in on the property. In hindsight, it was brilliant. He created a magnificent house, larger than anything at Scientist's Cliffs, but he designed it in a way that just fit in nicely.
Except the color. Everything was brown except his was gray, right?
Yes, yes, that's true. But he had magnificent views.
Yeah, no, it was a beautiful
of God's nature.
Yes.
He was forward-thinking enough. He built in a lap pool. That's a swimming pool that's probably 4, maybe 5 feet wide and probably 15 feet long. Not big, but when he hits the button, the water flows at whatever rate he sets. and he swims.
Mm-hmm.
He can paddle or he can swim fast, i.e. a beautiful built-in way to maintain physical strength. He also, in the basement, had probably 2,000 feet of storage space. Yeah, he had a furnace and air conditioner and laundry, but he also had files for his life's work was all carefully documented, put in files. His family for decades visited and enjoyed that. It was put into a trust for his family,
mm-hmm.
and they today still go back and revel in his space. I don't mean to divert from your topic, but Byron Hankey is such an interesting person. He has made such a wonderful impact on our lives, and I say our in a very royal sense. Everybody, knowingly or unknowingly, has been touched by his creativity.
Well, I remember him talking about, because we took a tour, we visited scientists' cliffs, and it was absolutely gorgeous. I mean, it's very unspoiled, very, very
still
rural.
Unspoiled.
It's still
yes.
unspoiled. Well, we went, what, about 16, 17 years ago, so, I haven't been for a while. It was the only time I went. But I remember him talking about using the model to set up, the model at Scientist Cliffs to set up associations. And then he and there was another lady, and I don't remember her name.
Well, let's go back.
Go back. I don't mean to
NAHB, ULI, and U.S. League of Savings Association realized something needed to be done. They searched for people who could create an organization that could, again, not be beholden to the developers or the attorneys or anybody else. And they asked Byron, because of his work on TB50,
mm-hmm.
to be the designer of what turned out to be CAI, Community Associations Institute. He took about a year, almost 2 years, to conceptualize, and then he drew in a couple of other people. David Rame, who was a significant builder in this country, again, a very rare individual, high standards, high goals, and high achievement. David Stahl, who was the executive director ULI, he had been the executive director of NAHB, so he had a big, broad grounding in his whole concept. And they looked for some layman who could spell condominium, and I was serendipitously tapped to work with them in the creation of CAI. So we took the basic concepts that Byron had drafted, and the three of us would sit down every month, different part of the country. We did this for 2 years. Every month we'd sit down and discuss the next steps. The end result was what we took to the bank, if you would, that we took to, I guess you call it the government, and officially incorporated and became an entity.
So what were the plans? What was CAI supposed to have done?
Well, I became a charter trustee and was the first vice president. The first president of CAI was May Russell.
Okay, that was the name.
She had been the president of a university on the East Coast, and then moved to California and became the manager of common interest communities in California. And she was the right person because of her educational and her professional work. She had accomplished an awful lot on Irvine Ranch, California. Unfortunately, she wasn't well. So out of the 2 years of her presidency, she only made, I think, two meetings, which meant me as the vice president effectively served as president during the first 2 years, and then I became president for the next several years. It was those years that much of what CAI is today was conceived, implemented, and institutionalized. That includes the GAP reports, which are individual, peer-reviewed, short 20-30-page descriptions of a common situation within the industry and how do you handle it with specific guidance and recommendations. Collectively, the GAP reports provide a library of the best knowledge available in the world on different subjects, be it assessments or rules and regulations or reserves or whatnot. All of those, Byron had a significant input into.
Was he ever on the board or?
No, he was always a
an advisor.
An advisor. Okay. For the first 2 years, he had a consulting contract to help. And after that, what so many of us, when we get involved in something that we really become deeply committed to, we continue whether we're paid or not. And Byron was that type. And he had a significant other, his wife, probably of 65, 5 years before they left us, a absolute partner and mm-hmm. and supporter.
What was the vision for CAI?
Well, the vision was to become the preeminent source of information, guidance, and assistance, to provide the training, education, designations, and credentials of the key skills involved in our property, and to do research on how to do everything better. I argue that we were and continue to be incredibly successful in becoming that preeminent source. A number of other organizations have attempted, have done significant things in their own areas, but never captured the national and now international. We have, I think it's 62 chapters throughout the United States and 8 around the rest of the world.
I know Saudi Arabia is one.
Oh, I can't name them all.
You don't? Okay, you don't know. I was just kind of curious.
But they are Australia. There is no other credible, independent, professional source of information guidance in the world that's consistent. I think it's important to go back to your question, what were we trying to do? we felt that there were five different disparate interests who are involved in real estate in common interest properties. You obviously have the builder-developer. In order for the builder-developer to do it, they need engineering, architects, and other skills. We call them
associates.
Associate. That's not quite the right term, but close.
Yeah.
and we needed the public officials. And, of course, we needed the manager. Now, I just mentioned four, and,
right.
And the fifth is the homeowner.
The board member, homeowner.
Well, no, the homeowner. The homeowner, the owners. Now, we get to the owners through their elected representatives, the board members. But the concept was every homeowner has a piece of the action, a stake in the success or failure of their community. And the original intent was to make sure that all of the other people who basically are mercenary for-profit people were effectively supporting and available to the homeowner to assure that their property, their governance, was successful. As we structured it, these five interest groups, builder, developer, manager, public official, manager, and homeowner.
Homeowner.
If you could get all of those five interest groups to agree on something, you could take that to the bank. It would really be useful. So we established the governance of CAI, five interest groups. So we always had our board members, there were five, and then 10 and 15 and 25 and 30 as we grew. A balance so that we assured that each different thinking, different economics, different everything was included, balanced in decisions. And I think even today, policies still try to do that. I totally support, and a lot's been written by myself and others, that concept was a social experiment. Can we work together? Can we listen to everybody else's ideas and come up with something that's good for the whole? I believe in my heart we can. About 15 years, maybe 20 years, into CAI, it became very successful. The managers and the attorneys, the ones who had their primary income from common interest communities, was able to wrestle governance control from the five interest groups and effectively placed it in themselves. And CAI gravitated away from this wonderful social experiment to a equivalent of a trade association for the managers and the attorneys.
You're quoted as saying that the experiment was a failure. It was a flawed.
I didn't say that. I never said it was a failure or a fraud.
Flawed, not fraud. Flawed concept, because the five groups did not manage to work together. Ultimately,
well,
did not manage to stick together.
Not quite. The general concept of what you're saying is correct. It hasn't worked, and now this is a larger topic. I think that human nature drives us to do what we want to do, but I think that our creation, on the other hand, guides us to be communal and to work together. We have seen over the last, I'd say two decades, but accelerated in the last decade, a shift from we to me. We used to always say, what should we do? What's best for all of us? And now the overwhelming number of people are either the ones that speak up and heard and are the ones that say, what can I get out of it? So the emphasis on leadership, governance, guidance, operation is me, me, me.
It's interesting when you named the five groups, the initial groups that, and actually CAI was to form an umbrella and bring these groups under one umbrella, right?
That's right.
But the attorneys were never mentioned. They were not part of that because they didn't have a field.
Well, the attorneys were.
Associates.
The associate category, i.e. all the others.
Right.
In our conception of the Institute, all of the support professionals, the attorneys, the accountants, the auditors, all were in one group because their motivations, their training and so forth are all specialized.
Right.
And not inherently looking out for the common good.
But when you started CAI, there was no legal subject or no legal thing for community association law because it was evolving. I mean, a lot of the attorneys have said that they sort of created it. I mean, they're still creating it. They're still writing legislation.
We'll go back to TB 50.
Okay.
Byron Hankey collected in TB 50 some of the finest sets of documents that existed in the country. And through the comparison and critique, they became the model of how declarations, bylaws, rules and regulations should be created and implemented and monitored. As such, for several decades, attorneys referred to TB 50, and as they're all wont to do, they just copy the things that they like.
Yeah.
And now over time, those who have their own axe to grind have made subtle modifications that shift it from the we to enable the me. It's no different than what we have in this country.
It's sad because what you do see is that it has changed from the concept. Not that I agree with shunting everybody into an association, a mandatory membership association. I think there ought to be choices. I think anybody, and until recently you did not live in one, right?
I have owned and I have served on the board and been president of a dozen condominiums, cooperatives, and homeowners associations collectively. So I've lived in common interest communities. But the last 30, well, I've always lived in a single-family detached home. For the last 50 years has been in common interest communities. This is the second time in my life now that I'm living in a high-rise condominium.
So, okay, but it was always in an HOA, in some kind of community.
I've lived and managed and consulted to cooperatives.
We don't have a whole lot of cooperatives in Virginia anymore. They just never really survived, did they?
Well, I would argue they've survived better than the others, but you're right, there's not many. It's probably 5 or 7% of the communities that are cooperatives.
That many?
Yes, even here.
Because the ones that I dealt with when I was in real estate have converted to condominiums. And I remember having listings and having to...
A number have, but some of the, I would argue, finer cooperatives in our area now, in the Washington metropolitan area.
Okay, no, I'm talking about Northern Virginia. Northern
Virginia has a handful, only.
Because they had more that converted to...
No, that's true.
They converted to...
That is true.
To condominiums because they weren't selling. People didn't understand them. They didn't know how to live in them. They never, you know, they just didn't really take off.
You just used a term, Shu, that's critically important to all this discussion, understand.
Yeah.
Most people increasingly today look at this surface, the sound bites, and don't internalize the implication. Common interest communities are a very viable, very useful, and very economically successful housing approach, and they carry a different type of situation. And unless that's communicated, understood, and appreciated, it is subject to abuse and failure.
So CAI was supposed to make sure that people understood that, right? Is that what you said?
That's one of its goals.
And if people still, half a century later, don't understand them?
Well, I'm not willing to accept that broad brush negative. Today there's 370,000 common interest communities in the United States. CAI has at best 10% of them as members. It should have 50, 60, 70%. And if it did, there would be no question that everybody would be aware of and could be trained and could be...
Link, I'm talking about the housing consumers who are buying. You've got young people who are moving up.
And almost all of them deal through realtors. And realtors' primary objective is to get the commission. And if there are details that aren't communicated that enable the sale, the better. We've worked for a long time to try to get NAR and other groups to train the realtors in what is the condominium. And when we do...
You keep going back to condominium, but that's just one segment.
That's just one piece.
Yes. You're looking at a much bigger thing there.
Yes. Well, When I keep going back to the word condominium, I'm using it as a short for common interest communities.
Okay, because some people always say HOA, and then some people say, you can't say HOA because that's not all that we have. We have other issues. So residential associations probably would be a better term to cover everything. So you are in favor of having some really good disclosure packets, explaining exactly
I'm certainly in favor of disclosure packets, and most jurisdictions now have institutionalized disclosure packets. Disclosure packets mandate the visibility on all of the important aspects of the community. I mean, that's a no-brainer. What is missing, has always been missing, is an understanding of what is presented. People receive the packet, say, "Oh, good! Now I have everything I need," and they put it aside. They ought to internalize it, because the disclosure packet almost always contains all of the information you should know in order to be a good, thoughtful, objective buyer and a good owner resident.
You know, earlier you were talking about finding a document that was 2 pages long. I can see handing someone a document that's 2 pages long and saying, please read this before I put you in my car and drive you around and show you houses. But we wait until they've fallen in love with a house. We sign a contract. We have a contract. We've gone through all the financial stuff several days before. And sometimes at the settlement, it shouldn't be, but they end up with a stack of paperwork. They're not going to read it. There's no way they're going to internalize that. And when you look at all the legal mumbo jumbo, even the attorneys don't understand it. It's so poorly written that, you know, let's go back to the 2 pages.
The very first publications that CAI created and populated, they're still available but through government printing office. One was buying, one was selling,
okay,
and one was, I forget, buying, selling, I guess, and operating in a common interest community. It was a small brochure of the equivalent of maybe 4 pages, but it was presented in smaller size, so it was probably 12 pages. Very simple guides that would answer the questions that you were asking. It's still around, but you're right. We've encumbered the transfer of ownership into a legal morass.
Yeah.
And you're right that most attorneys get their fees for saying, sign here. It takes a little bit of analysis, not much, to quickly determine whether the association is financially sound, whether it's properly led, whether things are whole or not. And every owner ought to know that before they buy.
So what happens when an owner tries to get that information? Because I get a lot of calls from people saying, I've been trying to get the financial information from the association. They won't give it to me. That's usually a ding, ding, ding. There's a red bell there.
I don't dispute that's happening. But there's no excuse for that.
I agree.
The law requires it.
I agree.
It's pretty straightforward. It's very useful. And if I ever run into that situation, I will just go up the chain of command and make sure it gets there.
Chain of command?
Well, specifically the resale package or the disclosure packet. Who is it prepared by? Typically, it's prepared by the management company that's been engaged by the association to handle the administrative and financial matters. It sometimes is done by an individual, but in any event, it's mandated so that people have no excuse to not provide it, and it's essential. We should never allow it to not be there timely.
And I think one of the other things, too, that seems to be creating all kinds of problems is the vague legalese that's in a lot of the governing documents. You're laughing. Guys, he's laughing here. He's smiling. So he knows exactly what I'm talking about. So it's anybody can, I mean, some of these things have got loopholes that are so huge you could throw a whole house through them. And that's not necessarily right or fair.
No. And when those occur, if you back up and see who did it and how and why, I think you'll find a profit motive that it is prostituting our system.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that.
And again, that's kind of human nature. It happens. We have to keep our eyes open and make sure that we don't get caught. But that's a larger issue. We always ought to keep our eyes open, be aware, ask questions, and don't do things on blind faith. Trust, but verify.
You know, all of these people are members of CAI. And CAI is sort of this big umbrella group, this trade organization. Should CAI be policing itself and making sure that its members, because this reflects very poorly on CAI. And well, I don't necessarily see Tom Skiba saying, hey, attorney, we're going to kick you out if you're not being honest and above board. Instead, they tend to make excuses for them.
I will argue that is the new normal in this country. We see it in government.
Yep, we do.
And I agree with you that it's absolutely wrong. History shows so clearly that when you do things right, when you follow the rules, when you abide by the golden rule, a lot of the problems we have, a lot of the difficulties don't occur.
I agree. Link, we've got about 5 minutes left.
Okay.
And we started off by taking a trip down memory lane. I'd like to go back down, only not memory lane, and start from the scratch. If you could do it all over again, is there anything you would do differently? And what would you make sure that you covered, or is there something you missed?
You know, that's a very profound question. I sincerely believe that most of what I did within CAI, I would do again. The one thing different is that I think I would have fought harder, communicated more when I saw things going away from what I believe in. We have a funny social modus operandi in our culture. When I challenge the softening of the rules and ignoring transgressions, I was temporarily purged from involvement in the Institute.
Oh, really?
At one point, about 10 years into the Institute, all corporate records disappeared. And
wow.
And in fact, when we had our 40th anniversary, okay, the official historian started the history 10 years after we were incorporated, because they wanted to, somebody wanted to change the history. So this is the long way of saying that, you know, I was an executive of IBM with a lot of responsibilities, a lot of employees, while I was working, setting up CAI. I couldn't, and bringing a family up, I chose not to throw that out and focus totally on CAI. So it's, if there was something different, I would carve out a different life to put more time into it. But I still believe in my heart that good and justice prevails if it's followed.
I have one final question for you. And the first time I talked to you, I asked you, and I warned you I was going to ask you this. I asked you why you set up the associations. Do you remember what you told me? I do.
No, specifically I do not.
I remember you talking about barn raising. I remember you talking about this area being so transient, where people come in and they go out and they don't have families. And you talk about out in the country where farmers would go to church and they'd put up a little sign. Do you remember now?
Yes.
You want to tell us?
No, go ahead.
That, you know, we're going to be raising a barn on the next Sunday or whenever. And then everybody would show up. The wives would cook and they'd bring food. The kids would come, they'd play, and all the guys would get together. And by the end of the day, they'd have a new barn set up, and it was a community. And you wanted to create that kind of a community. That hasn't happened.
That has not happened.
That has not happened.
And that is to a large degree why I'm significantly involved today in helping CAI with its new think tank. What we've done here is bring some of the industry giants, people who are running large corporations, involved in our industry, and taking them out of their operating positions and asking them to think creatively outside the box. Let's look at what we have. It isn't working as well as it should. What should be done going forward? Very heavily in this is, whether we like it or not, we're all getting older.
Not me, Link.
as we age, we know there are certain declines, deteriorations, and we know now in common interest communities, we have a huge growing number of seniors who are less vital, less mobile, and sometimes a problem. How do we deal with it? What do we do? And this think tank is dedicated toward thinking these things outside the box. I'm very optimistic that with that creativity, with that thought and energy, that will set a new set of standards for ethics, standards, goals, objectives.
Would you come back and talk about that link?
I'd love to.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that you came in and talked to us. Thanks to all of you.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.